Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series, hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and the New Books Network partnership provide a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobilities and method. My name is Lakshita Malik, and today I'm joined by Dr. Gabriel Dattasrayan, senior lecturer at the Department of Anthropology at Goldsmiths University of London. We are in conversation about his book, The Globally Familiar, Digital Hip-Hop, Masculinity, and Urban Space in Delhi, published by the Duke University Press, set to release in October 2020. We look forward to hearing from Dr. Dattasrayan about his new book. So welcome, Gabriel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, my pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we'll just quickly start. And the first question I'd like to ask you is just how did this project get conceived? And how did you start working on these concepts of gendered aspirational mobilities through digital hip hop?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was sitting in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So I did my PhD at the University of Pennsylvania and just kind of, you know, trying to think through how to explore a set of questions around really loosely around kind of gendered, racialized subjectivity in South Asia. So what I had noticed in my training and just in my, you know, my relationship with urban India. So my family's from India. I grew up in the US, but I spent quite a bit of time going back and forth between Delhi, Bangalore, Chennai, and the US, New York, where I grew up. And one of the things that I grew up noticing, but then also, you know, very quickly saw in the literature on urban gendered subjectivities was that there was very little kind of to say about those who were not occupying very visible kind of positions, right? So while there's been a lot said and written about upper caste, middle class masculinities in India, there's been very little said about migrants, lower caste subjectivities. And so I started to kind of think about how I might approach these questions without kind of reproducing a problematic entry point or method. And by that, I mean, you know, looking for the kind of subaltern subject and trying to find that authentic subaltern subject was not what I wanted to reproduce, right? So, as I was sitting in Philly, I started to see through some of my networks videos of kids in Bombay, but then also in Delhi, dancing, throwing up graffiti pieces, really kind of engaging with hip hop. And it got me really curious about who these young people were, who these young men in particular were. And so I went out for my first just kind of exploratory field visit in 2012 and ended up meeting a whole bunch of young people very quickly in Delhi, whose backgrounds were incredibly diverse, right? So there were young people whose parents were from Garhwal that had come to Delhi in the previous decade to find work. They were Afghan refugees. There were Somali refugees. There were kids from Bihar who had also had their parents come to Delhi to find work, mainly in the construction sector. So the city was undergoing this big boom at that time. And so just kind of finding this milieu that I had not anticipated, all because I was kind of interested, right, in these larger questions around what kind of urbanization produces in terms of male subjectivities, but then this kind of very specific interest in like who's producing hip hop all of a sudden in urban India in 2010-11, right? So that was a question that started to get shaped, I guess, primarily because I had thought about popular cultural circulation between North America in particular and India in previous decades, so in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, I was very familiar from my own experience, how much those circulations had to do with diasporic movement between and transnational movement between. But these movements were always, they were always framed in a very particular casted mobility. And so I was just really kind of excited to figure out like how popular culture in this moment was getting kind of circulated and picked up. And so, I mean, it didn't occur to me, but I guess when I got there, it was like so clear, obviously, this had everything to do with 3G, 4G networks and the kinds of infrastructure that enabled them.
Yeah, thank you so much for your answer. The other thing that I found really interesting about your text was that future imaginations and futurities figure very importantly. And you sort of pitched this questions of reproductions of hip hop and recreation of like hip hop dance or song or music or whatever it is, parallelly with the policy decisions and how the master plan, for instance, of Delhi sees Delhi's future, right? So what made you sort of decide to pitch these sort of contradicting, maybe? I don't know if they're contradicting ideas of futurities, right? Where they're coming from.
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I think spending time in Delhi in this last decade, it's kind of hard to avoid the impact of what this kind of world-class imaginary has done to reshape infrastructure, but then aesthetic as well, right? So the whole city feels like it's convulsed into becoming something other than what it was prior to 2007, 2008. And we can mark the kinds of shifts in very specific events, right? So the kind of events that spur on particular projects of development. So I'm thinking of the games, right? The Commonwealth Games, Asiad Games, that moment. I'm thinking of like the development of the metro and all of that, right? So, I mean, it's kind of like this impact of post-liberalization development projects. It's just so visceral. When you spend any time in Delhi, if you have a history, especially with the city, it's so visceral. And so trying to think about how these developments have reshaped the city and what impacts it's had, particularly on those who live on the margins of the city, right, has been a project that's been quite well-developed in the last couple of decades. I think it's something that's been thought of. And so, you know, the way that this kind of relationship is narrated is that there's a top-down development strategy or project, and then the recipients of those projects, the people that have the least say in the way that it's imagined, you know, either kind of succumb to its excesses or are succumb in the sense that they're displaced, they're kind of immiserated in some way or the other, or there's a resistance, right? There's a particular kind of organizing political resistance that happens. And, you know, spending time with these kids that I got to know, these young men between the ages of 15 and 24, started to get me to think, okay, so there's another way that this kind of reimagining of the capital city, but really reimagining of Indian urbanity, right, takes place. And that is that it seeds an opening or an opportunity to kind of imagine on different terms what futures could look like. And, you know, that has everything to do with infrastructures, right? So as I was saying before, the 3G, 4G networks become a kind of conduit by which to imagine through both consumption and production of audio media materials, content for social media distribution, but then also through something like the metro, right? So the metro becomes a kind of device for imagining futures that are ultimately about mobility, right? They're about being able to traverse spaces that have otherwise been unavailable. And so, you know, really trying to think about and then trying to think through in this book how it's not so much a one-directional process, right? When we think about development and kind of urban imaginaries and urban futures, but it's this dialectic process that produces all sorts of unexpected possibilities and consequences, right?
Right. No, thank you. That was great. The other thing that I'd like to ask, and now I'm going to go back to the title, which I thought was really interesting, The Globally Familiar. And I'm wondering what familiarity or evoking familiarity does for the transnational movement or the understanding of transnational movement and traffic of images, sounds, and aesthetics, for instance.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I had originally conceptualized this project for my PhD work around the concept of citizenship. And I was playing with this idea of aesthetic citizenship, right? So what does it mean to kind of produce content that then enables enfranchisement and participation in all of these ways, economic, social, sometimes even political, right? And as I was kind of thinking about citizenship, I started to feel like the concept was overburdened. It didn't allow me to kind of think about a kind of conceptual space beyond the state and allow myself to kind of really, really kind of open up how this move to self-make through social media and through hip hop and social media was much more trans-historical and trans-spatial, right? So the familiar was my attempt to try to kind of capture some of what it means to, you know, as I kind of describe in the book, take up 1970s New York, right? And its particular styles and articulations of urban shift and change. And, you know, like the Bronx, for instance, became this symbol for a lot of the young men that I got to know. The Bronx, the Boogie Down, right? Like became the symbol for them to understand what they were going through in Delhi in 2012, 13, right? So really trying to think about what was familiar for them or what they felt was something that they could grab onto that felt connected to their experience in Delhi. And so this idea of the familiar started kind of to come out of that. Then there's the theoretical side of it, right? So this was very much about what I was observing that got me to this place to think through and theorize the familiar as a way to understand the circulation of images, sounds, from one particular moment, a kind of chronotopic New York circa 1970s to Delhi 2012. The other way I was thinking about it was vis-a-vis linguistic anthropology, right? And so a lot of the work in linguistic anthropology has been pushing us to think about mediation vis-a-vis terms that become kind of that move into circulation and then get enregistered into language, right? So for example, I use swag quite a bit in the talks. In the talks that I do on my book, right? So swag is a really great term because it's a term that can be used linguistically. You know, it's a term that's taken to mean kind of style. It's a very gendered term, right? So swag is like a very masculinist kind of way of being in the world and a style, but it's also objects or things in the world, right? So one thing we can do is we can trace something like swag as it moves from a North American context where it gets produced, right, as a term mainly within Black communities, right? So it's a linguistic term that emerges out of again a socio-historical specificity, and then it travels to someplace like Delhi where it gets picked up and used, right? And so in its movement, it does something really interesting. It both stays the same in that it indexes a very particular way of being in the world that's very gendered and the particular things that make it so, but then it also changes, right? So it also shifts, it becomes a shifter. It starts to mean something new in use in Delhi. And so the familiar to me is a way to track and trace these kinds of terms. And the kind of material, I suppose the materiality of these terms, right? So how they become imbued into objects, into images, into a way of seeing the city, into seeing the subject.
The other thing that I was, obviously you mentioned this, even as you were talking about how this project was sort of, how this came to life, was the dearth of literature on non-elite masculinity, lower caste masculinity, lower class masculinity in the Indian context. I was wondering if you could go into some detail about this sort of everyday globality of non-elite young men who have these complex relationships with the term that you use as aspiration, right? And how they get sort of, what does it mean, right? It's not the same thing, aspiration, which we take for granted in quite a bit these days, but you evoke it differently. It's a generationally different concept here as well. So I was wondering if you could go into that a little bit.
Oh, that's great. So I think there's two parts to your question, if I'm not mistaken. So one is to kind of think about aspiration quite specifically as a located, right, and very intersectionally located term with these young men. And the other is to think about kind of the dearth in literature more broadly, right? And so to the latter, I would say, so I was spending quite a lot of time trying to figure out what, at some point in the last few years, what's been written about men in India specifically. And it was quite interesting. I found all these studies on semen and like very kind of Hindu conceptions of control, right? That are related back to kind of bodily secretions. There was you know, interesting literature on Palwans, on wrestlers. So Joseph Adler's work, for example, really thinking about kind of traditions of masculinity and moral kind of frameworks of masculinity. But you know, what became very evident to me, and Sarita Amrute actually writes about this in a cultural, in a public culture piece that she wrote about the Delhi rape case. So Sarita, who's a dear friend of mine, wrote, and I mean, we've had conversations about this as well, about how, you know, in the tradition of anthropology, certainly, but I think also in other kind of scholarly traditions, the village and the city, right? So sociology has this as well. So the village and the city get split, right? Anthropology takes on the village, the city gets taken on by sociology, right? So the kind of spatialization of social life then necessarily leads to very particular and peculiar ways of talking about gender, and talking about gender in relationship to religion and so on. And so, you know, there seems to be like these two strands then of literature that emerge around masculinity in South Asian scholarship and specifically India scholarship, right? So you have these kind of more village studies that focus on the kind of religious moral subject and the way that they kind of shape themselves, right, in and through religion. And then you have the urban study, which is also still focused is often implicitly, right, on Hindu subjects, right, but middle class secular Hindu subjects who produce themselves as masculine subjects vis-a-vis consumption and so on. And so there's some exceptions, of course. Like I think of Sanjay Srivastava's work. You know, he's interesting because he's kind of thinking, in like a little bit more of a kind of a little bit more of a broad way about how to think through masculinities in India. And some of his pieces have been, you know, very, very influential and helpful to think with, particularly his work on Bajrang Dal and youth and in Delhi, right? So, you know, where I depart from that work as well is that I think often there's a compulsion, particularly in anthropology, there's a compulsion to want to keep the story spatialized so that the largest scale that one can kind of engage with is the nation state. And I think that there's a lot of value in that, right? I think that there's a lot of value in thinking about the national and thinking about that as a scale by which to understand particular processes of change, movement, mobility, and all of that. But I think, you know, as several scholars in the 90s have argued, that methodological nationalism can be a huge limit to what we can see and what we're able to engage with. And it doesn't allow us to see flows across, right? And those flows can be mediated flows, like what I pay attention to in this book. But they can also be other types of flows. I think of, you know, Inderpal Grewal's book. The title is escaping me, but there's this one amazing chapter about Barbie dolls. I don't know if you've ever read this, but it's about Barbie dolls in Delhi and how, you know, young people growing up in Delhi see these manifestations of American genderedness, right? And they imbibe it, right? That there's this sense that we need to kind of think about things in movement, like Barbie dolls or, you know, Kendrick Lamar videos, and think about what they're doing in their movement as they arrive, right? And they cross national boundaries and arrive someplace new.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. No, thank you for that. That was great. The other sort of part that was really interesting about your text, and it keeps coming up in your writing, is this engagement with this multi-sited, multimedia methodology. You talk about your own presence in the field as sort of, for instance, helping your interlocutors record music, right? Or putting up concerts. And I was wondering if you could talk more about your positioning in the field, right? And how that space and those intimate relationships of quote-unquote research are forged. I know a lot of graduate students like me who are going into the field would be interested in that.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, one of the things I was very cognizant of before I even like sat down to try to conceptualize a project, right? So, you know, we go through these rites of passage, right? Where we have to write this proposal, defend the proposal before we go off into the field. In the American Academy, at least here in the UK, where I've been training PhD students, they come in with a more or less kind of fully formed research agenda and project, right? But in either case, I think, you know, we're trying to kind of do, especially in the discipline of anthropology or any discipline that uses ethnography as a method, right, which is so filled with potential, the potential for kind of thinking of yourself as an instrument rather than thinking, you know, of and the relations you build as an instrument as kind of central to the process of doing the research rather than thinking about the world out there as inert and the idea, you know, that this kind of fantasy that we're collecting data, right? So, you know, ethnography to me is a very kind of vital, alive, relational process. And so for me, a big question, you know, going to the field and even deciding kind of thinking through what I was going to do as a project to answer these bigger questions I had was to try to think about where I could actually build relationships and where I would be able to actually be useful, right? And so, you know, the burgeoning hip hop scene in Delhi was a space that I immediately thought, okay, so there's some really interesting questions. Those are my larger questions could be translated into really interesting kind of more specific questions that I could ask here. But more importantly, right, I think I could, I at least believed as I was going that I could arrive and be able to offer something in the way of my audiovisual skills as a filmmaker, someone who's made or produced music in the past, right? As someone who could also be in some ways, and I write about this in the book, right? A familiar that is manifest, right? Someone who grew up with hip hop as an Indian American in New York, all of a sudden popping up, right, in Delhi, in some ways kind of fulfilling the kind of aspiration, right, for why a lot of these young men were doing this in the first place, which was to connect to a broader world. And so, you know, I showed up to Delhi and immediately, you know, I think I within the first week of that trip I told you earlier about the 2012 kind of exploratory trip. Within a week of arriving, I had my camera out and I was shooting a music video. Like one of the first, you know, kind of attempts at a music video in the scene, and developed relationships with some of the artists who are now huge, right, in India. And were starting to get international acclaim, like making work with them, you know, when they were 17, 18 year old kids, just trying to figure out what they were going to do in the future. And so those processes of production and creation with were both amazing in so far as I could provide something, but they're also just in the practice of making together opened up so many frames for collective analysis that I hadn't anticipated, right? So there was this opportunity there for collaborative ethnographic work to take place. And out of that came a couple of film projects that I shot with a couple of the groups of young men that I worked with. There was also room for friction, right? So the thing about showing up with a camera and then working with some crews of young men over others is going to create some issues, right? Mm-hmm. There were other diasporic actors on the ground who had gotten there before me, who were very much about trying to kind of connect in with the burgeoning scene in India and connect their own kind of Indian diasporic relationship with hip hop to it and influence it. And so then saw me as a kind of interloper, potential threat, right? There were all sorts of, you know, potentials for friction that emerged out of this. But by and large, I mean, you know, the frictions also taught me so much. So by and large, this kind of approach, this hip hop ography approach to doing ethnography in Delhi opened up all sorts of ways to think about changing city, to think about masculinity, and to think about digital media.
Right. No, thank you for that. And the one thing, of course, that you mentioned and sort of conceptually sort of highlighted in your text is not only do these circulations of soundscapes and dance movements and images involve like stylistic imitation, which is also laborious and creative in its own right, but also aesthetically reproducing them on cameras, the social media platforms for these young men, right? And producing what you call effective commodities. I was wondering what this relationship, why was this conceptually necessary to highlight this labor that is put into aesthetically recreating what they're not just imitating dance movements, but aesthetically recreating them on social media platforms.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, so I mean, what I quickly figured out was the kind of creative self-making play that a lot of these young men were endeavoring in their small groups was quickly getting recognized in various arenas in Delhi as potentially value producing projects, right? So value producing insofar as the images themselves, but then the images as related to or connected to commodities could do the work of kind of marketing or branding newcomer labels, but then also established labels or brands in India. And so we have to kind of step back and kind of understand this a little bit more, right? Kind of broadly. So I think, you know, I arrived to do this research in India in a very particular moment. So it was 2012, right? And it was a moment where there was a sense, right, that there needed to be an investment in the youth markets in India. I mean, there was all these articles in 2010 and 11, actually, that were popping up in Business Week and, like, I don't know, some of the Outlook India about the untapped Indian market, youth market, sorry, whose numbers are staggering, right? Like the number of young people under the age of 35 in India is something like 600 million. So, and then, you know, a large majority of those 600 million live in urban areas. And so I started to see how these young men's serious play with each other, right, was quickly getting attention, which is something that they wanted, and that that attention was translating into the potential for them to earn a living in various ways, right? So I talk about that a little bit in the book, that the various kinds of work opportunities that kind of open up. I also talk a little bit about how branding agents, right, start to kind of imagine the future of this, the future of this kind of play as a potential. And, you know, I finished writing the book as a dissertation in 2014, 15. So since then, so what I end with in the book is like, look, there's this moment where these affective commodities are coming into visibility, right? So the practice of these young people is it's getting captured on in image and in sound, is now being tied to particular consumption practices and activities and brands. So fast forward 5 years, I mean, that market is now exploded. So when I arrived, Sony India, hip hop wasn't on their radar. And now, you know, just hearing from some of the guys who've made it big, like these bigger entities like Sony are scouring for the next talent because they know that there's so much money to be made, right? Vis-a-vis these artists. And it's not just the music business, right? So it cross-cuts from kind of larger scale national media type conglomerates or transnational or international media type conglomerates to clubs in Delhi that need customers, right? And so look on YouTube to find who's got the most hits and then invite those artists to play.
Right. Yeah. Relating to that question of like finding work and where these artists pluck themselves vis-a-vis like new occupational aspirations, different from their parents. You talk about like them being club promoters, for instance, right? But also talking about the harshly unequal ways in which they become a part of these circuits. And you also, in relation to that, mention some of the political disruptions that these performances are able to make by these artists. And I was wondering how, if you could like talk more about that.
Sure. So another two-part question. So the first part, is really kind of thinking about inequality, and you know what I would describe as kind of as a racialized hierarchy of labor in a city like Delhi. And so you know one thing I describe is how much, you know, the young people who I work with, how much their parents, based on their ethnic backgrounds, get slotted into particular kinds of work, right? So, for instance, Northeastern migrants, so from Assam and Manipal and so on, you know, when they come to Delhi, their parents, so the elder generation, end up working often as, so if you're, and it's also gendered, right? So it's racialized and gendered labor. So if you're a woman, you end up kind of getting slotted into doing service labor work, either in a shop or domestic labor in a person's home. You know, when I lived in Delhi, so much of the middle class kind of Delhiite, Hindu middle class narrative was, oh, Northeastern women, they make the best ayahs. They make the best like childcare, right, workers. Mm-hmm. So we just have to understand that these labor regimes, these racialized labor regimes are so hardwired. Like the Bihari man is always the construction worker, right? They work in in various forms of construction and what would be, I suppose, called in North America and Europe, blue collar work. Right, so factory work and so on. And so, you know, their children, they arrive to a city like Delhi and maybe they attend school for a while, but they start to see that there are these pathways that are quite narrow, right? Like that they feel like, and this was something that many of the young men told me, right? Like they feel like they're just being tracked right into a particular form of labor, of work. And, you know, this kind of move to hip hop was a way to kind of try to disrupt that and try to find other ways of being in the world and making one's way in the world and making one's living in the world as a man. But the thing is these new opportunities as they started to arise, started to congeal around types, right? They too started to become kind of racialized labor formations. So that club promoters, right, working the circuits and the deli clubs tended to be Northeastern. The bartenders tended to be, you know, the people who worked inside the space tended to be upper caste, right? Hindus, the bouncers tended to be Gujars and Jats, right? I mean, it just reproduced itself, this kind of racialized regime of masculine labor in all sorts of predictable ways, I suppose one could say. So, you know, I think that's something that I grew really interested in, and I wrote something about in the book. I mean, I think that kind of reproduction and mutation of labor regimes, I think could be there could be a lot more written about that. But I touch upon that in the book for sure. Now, the second part of your question, I have already forgotten.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry about that. But that was more about the political disruption. I'm sorry, I'm just trying to pack as much in. So.
Sure, no problem. So yeah. Political disruption. So, you know, hip hop is a, you know, I would argue is an inherently political aesthetic form. So it, you know, it emerges out of Black urban life in the U.S., which has its own particular histories of migration, right? And then its own particular racialized histories of marginalization and segregation. And you know, we're seeing again, right, in this moment with George Floyd and BLM, like the kind of constant afterlives, the constant reproduction of the afterlives of transatlantic slavery in the U.S. And hip hop is, you know, part and parcel of that story. It emerges out of that story. It's a quintessentially political art form as a result. So I think, you know, hip hop's interesting, right? Because it travels, it's moved, it emerged in the late 1970s in the U.S. By the time I was 10, so I'm going to give away my age here. So by the time I was 12, it was 1986, right? And I had my first fat tip marker. And I was like, when my parents weren't looking, I was tagging up poles in New York City subway stations, right? Me, a little Indian kid, 12-year-old Indian kid, right? you know, had found something about this aesthetic form that allowed me to disrupt, right, already at the age of 12, an idea of what the world is and how it should be constituted, right? And that's been the appeal of hip hop since it's emerged. So it quickly became, you know, I would say by the time I started writing or tagging up poles in New York City, it was already a multi-billion-dollar industry worldwide. So it's been picked up, appropriated, you know, sincerely, insincerely, and so on, all across the world. And so, you know, it arrives in India in this way, this kind of fulsome way, right, where it gets picked up in mass, and it gets picked up by those on the margins in a city like Delhi in 2008, 2009, 2010. And you know, a big part of the appeal, right, is this potential it has to rupture, to break norms, to produce maybe the potential for a different kind of future, and then a future that's about collective life, right? Collective life that's not bounded by pre-formed categories. But then, you know, the possibility of making money, right, also emerges simultaneously. The possibility of being an individual making it through something like hip hop. So it replays its story, hip hop, in a sense, you know, its tension, the tension of its origin, right? Like coming out of New York City, replays itself in a place like Delhi. I just wrote a piece with a friend of mine, Jaspal Singh, for a journal called, it's a brand new journal, it's Global Hip Hop Studies. And we write about DIY studios and precisely this tension, right? This potential for hip hop to be political, to actually rupture, push back, and then its commercial promise. And so the scene I think you read that I kind of talk about this with was a scene where this young man all of a sudden in this event that's on a college campus in South Delhi, right? So he's just won a b-boying prize. So he's got a trophy in his hand. He's asked to say a few words, maybe rap a little bit. And he starts to kind of talk a little bit about the Delhi rape case to this middle class, right? Upper caste college audience. And then he starts to talk about his own kind of getting slotted, right? So he talks about working at McDonald's and like that's his future, right? And he starts to get, you know, agitated and passionate. And in that moment, you can kind of see both, right? Both of these strands of hip hop's possibility, right? Its politicality and its possibility for producing an economic future come together. And that I was really, I continue to be fascinated by.
Right. No, thank you. That was great. One last question. It doesn't have to be a long answer, but it's about intimacy. And that's such a crucial theme in your book, not only the intimacy between you and your interlocutors, but the intimacy between these young men, right, who perform together and practice together. And also, especially in a climate where groups of lower class, lower caste young men are automatically seen as threatening, especially in the light of the Delhi rape case that you mentioned. What does this mean, positioning yourself within this, being intimate as like lower caste male in whatever capacity in public spaces where you're perceived as a threat?
Yeah, it's that's a nice question. So I think, you know, it was always fascinating for me to go with groups, different crews of young men when they went to go practice in different public spaces. So, you know, the threat they posed actually. So I'll give a couple of examples, right? So, and I write about this in a chapter in the collected volume about my trips to one of these big malls in South Delhi, right, which is right across the street from the urban village where one of the crews that I was spending time with lived. So we would cross this really busy road. We would have to like dodge cars and jump over a fence between in the barricade and cross the roads. And then we'd get to the security area. And the people that were most threatened, or the people who felt the most kind of worried about these young people walking into the mall, were often young men, a little bit older than these kids, who were working as security guards, right? So often, again, thinking about those racialized regimes of labor, these were men that came from, you know, from some of the same places the young men I was working with came from. They came from Bihar. I actually got to know a few of these particular, this set of security guards, just having gone there so many times, you know, and their anxiety was produced because they felt these kids so close to them, right? They were policing the boundaries of the mall for, you know, their employers with these young people in their minds as the people to keep out. But, you know, once the kids got in, they would start to dance and practice their moves. Sometimes they would have a rap cipher, and they would start attracting the middle class mall goers with their smartphones pulled out and trying to capture some of the fun. And they didn't threaten them at all, right? They were just another spectacle to consume in the mall. And I know Arlene Davila, who writes a lot about malls in South America, talks about how the mall outside of North America is actually a space for all sorts of intangible consumptions like this, right? Like in Latin America, certainly, and in India too, right? There's all of these kind of potential spontaneous happenings that become part and parcel of what the mall offers. So there was this really interesting moment, right? Like where I was going there, they were getting harassed by security guards. But then all these, you know, once they like managed to evade, the security guards get in and they were able to kind of practice on the thing and attract a crowd. There was a moment where a group of security guards came over to try to harass the crew that I was with. And what their boss essentially had been watching on CCTV the whole thing go down. And he came down from where he was sitting and he was like, "Why are you bothering these kids? They clearly are attracting an audience. They dance really well. Like, leave them alone." And it was a really it was an important moment, right? Like, it was a moment where it was like so clear what it means to kind of think about difference and think about hierarchies of labor in relationship to you know, consumer capitalism, which so easily, so seamlessly, like can appropriate, right, difference and make it productive in this way. And so, I mean, I think, you know, I think this tension got played out in all sorts of different ways in my time in Delhi. But, you know, maybe the takeaway here, right, is often those who do the policing around boundaries of spatialized difference, racialized difference, tend to be those who are actually also subordinated by the larger structures and systems, right? And those who, you know, those who are kind of in their bubbles, their middle class bubbles, don't have to do the immediate work of that. They can consume difference when they want, and then they can, you know, they can worry also about you know, the undesirable other in the safety of their homes watching TV. Like, they're not at the front lines, like, experiencing the frictions of these things, right? And there's something about that that's quite important, right? Especially as we start to think about the moment we're in India with, you know, the rise of fascist Hindutva, the continuous rise of fascist Hindutva over the last many years, right? So I have a friend, Sahana Udupa, who writes about extreme speech, and you know, the folks who sit in Twitter and kind of the bucks, the like digital bucks who sit on Twitter and like put out all sorts of hateful, Islamophobic, casteist stuff. Like, I wonder who they were in the mall, right? Like, were they one of those people that were sitting there videotaping the performance? Like, what did they think was going on? Like, who do they think these kids were? And I think, you know, I think these tensions are tensions that we need to kind of think about and tease out.
Right. Yeah, no, that was great. Thank you so much for your patience, but also thank you for joining us and for all of your wonderful insights. I'm Lakshata Malik, and this discussion of the globally familiar digital hip-hop, masculinity, and urban space in Delhi, published by Duke University Press, set to release in October 2020, has been brought to you by the New Books Network in association with Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And the first chapter of this book should be available to download. The introduction should be available to download soon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.